condition, my condition was ill.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
Hello and welcome back to Saxon Jack. I'm Tom Alley, Mr. Dave Scantina. Hacking around over on the board. What are you doing over there, God's sake? He's in after a couple of weeks' absence. He'll do fine. David, how are you? Good to have you back, buddy. Yeah, we have Mr. Lou Michaels with us as well. We have S&P futures up 30, NASDAQ futures up 144. This is between our president and our Federal Reserve guy managed to talk us up huge after the close. Plus, we have some pretty interesting earnings that makes you wonder. But again, I'm always in sort of a state of wonderment. I'm one of those guys that wonder what's happening. I don't know about that, but Lou, are you with us?
I am here. How are you?
I'm all right. Remember the three kinds of people in the world, right? Just saying.
Well, I would say they're more than that, but go ahead. What are they?
Some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and rest of the people wonder what happened.
I'll take it. I like that. I'll have to remember that the next time I'm writing a brief on on a discrimination case.
I listened to our Fed chairman all afternoon talk about there's no inflation or don't worry about it or it's something. And then I watched the earnings that came out after the close. An incredible increase that, what did Facebook say? They raised their ad revenue 30% in ad over year to year. And does a man want to act like a buffoon? And I hate like hell to even say that about anybody. But who exactly is his keeper that his job is to lie in front of people so he can pour money in so 50 people in his country can make money? I mean, what are we doing here, Lou?
I had a discussion, and I want there are a couple of things I want to push to the front of the agenda before we get too far into this. Yeah. But I had a discussion on Facebook with a couple of friends of mine, and they were talking about wealth inequality, and I think I upset them because I said, you know, wealth inequality under Donald Trump actually declined. It exploded under Barack Obama, and it's getting ready to explode again. But wealth equality under Trump actually declined. So I don't think you guys, and they were obviously Democrats, but I just said I don't think you guys have the have the formula right.
I don't see how that's true.
Everything got quiet, but
I don't think that's true. Right?
Income inequality did decline under Trump.
With the market doing what it did, how could it possibly decline when 1% of the people owned 90% of the market?
It declined because of employment. The Trump employment figures were the highest for minorities, especially the folks that were at the bottom of the equality ladder or income inequality ladder. It increased for minorities dramatically. It was the highest they've ever been. It wasn't the kind of decrease in income inequality that would be enough to offset the damage done under Obama and some of his predecessors. But I mean, you're exactly right. The government pumping all this money into the economy is typically aimed at the way it falls out. It benefits, you know, the top 10% or so of the population. It doesn't help most of the people. And we saw that play out under Obama. Maybe the same kinds of things would have played out under Trump, but the Trump economy was an economy that was driving very quickly toward full employment, and especially in the minority area with minorities. That's how income inequality declined. I didn't want to make a statement like that. That was my understanding, but I didn't want to make a statement like that without some basis. So I looked it up, and it was reported in September of 2020 and Reuters and a number of other places that the numbers had actually declined under Trump, although they were desperately trying not to.
There's no way the wealth numbers declined. There's no way. And the interesting part where you're talking about the employment numbers versus Trump versus that was absolutely a total figment of Trump's imagination. If you look at since Obama came out, Obama landed in office at a very bad time. obviously was.
Yes, he did.
And if you look at the increase in employment per month, it's damn near the exact same numbers in Obama's last 5 years.
I'm not talking about overall employment numbers within the economy, which you and I talk about the Labor Department's figures being inaccurate all the time. I'm talking about overall employment within minority communities, and it was at the highest level ever.
That
had an impact and an effect on you know, accumulated wealth and wealth inequality, the way wealth inequality is measured. And that's I just throw that out there because the formula that the Democrats seem to push and I you know, maybe it would have been the same under Trump, because he obviously was no fiscal conservative when it came to government spending. But you know, whatever was happening within his economy had a disproportionate beneficial impact on minority employment, and that closed the wealth gap.
I'm going to say, Lou, that both guys, after maybe 2010-11, were roughly 150 to 160,000 employees per month, which basically kept pace.
I get that,
but
that's
kept
not
pace
what I'm
with,
talking about.
It kept pace with population growth and left us in the same mess. And most of that employment was, a lot of it was in the lower end. But depending on when you got it, in other words, the minorities managed to benefit during Trump's time because they were probably the only people left. Well, I mean, so I mean, it's
I'm not going to argue. I'm just saying this is what actually happened during those 3 years from 2017 to 2020 until we forcibly shut the economy down.
But I don't say how. Okay, I'm trying to do my numbers shtick, which is what I do. That's why I always ask you the legal stuff. I don't see how the hell the numbers equate with the stock market damn near doubling with the Fed pouring that kind of money in, and 400,000 people getting a $15 an hour job. The numbers don't even come close, Will.
I'll just tell you to pull the numbers up in the articles.
Well, I mean,
and look at them.
I wonder. I'm just saying. I could use different numbers to come up with something totally different. Is what I'm saying. And that's the beauty of today's world.
My point is, nobody in the press was willing to give Donald Trump the time of day or any credit for anything.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
And so the idea that they were actually giving him credit on this, to my mind, means that the numbers were probably pretty good.
Well, they were good, but they're also so skewed now, Lou. You can't even go by it. I mean, there comes a time when you look at stock prices. All right, now when I started the business, you know, Lou Michaels Inc. was up $3, and that's how it was reported, or $2, or down $3. Then it became percentages. All right, because the percentage, obviously, if a stock that's $400 is up $3, it's not the same benefit as a stock was $10 up $3. I mean, we get that. But you also, numbers can lie going the other place. If the other way, if you've got a stock that's trading a buck and it's up to $1.10, it's up 10%. So what, Lou? It's up a friggin' dime. I mean, right? I mean, I'm saying you can do whatever you want with numbers.
I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just saying that the idea that somehow wealth inequality, you know, is an issue, and given the way we were measuring it, that wealth inequality was the huge problem, as you know, for the last whatever. You know, I said, well, then you've got to look at what steps happened or what things happened that actually decreased the number, and there were things within our last administration that decreased the number, and I, you know, we got to pay attention to that. That to me seems to be something that if I'm a social scientist or I'm a government policymaker, I look at that and say, well, you know, the only thing that's managed, if this is such a big problem, the only thing that put a dent in it was this government policy that effectively drove full employment.
Well,
so
I don't know if it was any kind of policy, but what I'm saying, Lou, is that you have You have
or lack of a policy,
right.
Lack of government involvement.
But you have, but you have real crazy stuff going on. And depending on how you ask the question, by the way, I'm not a pollster, but this week I've been listening to all these poll numbers, right? And Lou, I tell you what, you and I, we're not pollsters. We could. I heard one really ignorant one this weekend about people in the medical profession. Something like 15 or 20% of them have thought about leaving the profession because of COVID. Now, Lou, you and I easily, and I'm not a wordsmith, you're much better at it than I am, easily could say, I could go up to a group of attorneys and said, man, based on the fact that the courts were closed last year and it's harder and harder, everything's a Zoom meeting, did you ever think last year that maybe you didn't want to be an attorney anymore? If you don't get 15% of the people to say, yeah, I thought about it once or twice, something's wrong with you. But that doesn't
mean
it doesn't mean all quit, right? Or they got one deliver pizzas.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, I'd say on any given day in the last 20 years, you could walk into a law firm or into a courthouse and stick a microphone in front of an attorney and say, isn't there something you'd rather be doing? And the answer, 90% of them would say, yeah, probably.
You could have walked into the OEX pit when it was the hottest thing in the world and guys were dying to get in there. And at any given noon when you're sitting around without a trade, one around with a microphone, hey, did you ever think you want to do something other than trade? If you couldn't get 10 people to say yes, it doesn't mean they left, Lou. Right?
I mean, no, exactly. I discount polls now automatically because of the way the information is skewed and the way the questions get asked, and that's been going on since the second Bush administration, where I just listened to the way the questions were being asked, and I realized that the polls are being weaponized because they were one of the first mainstream press tools to be weaponized against whatever president or whatever policy you were trying to discuss, and the credulousness on some of these poll numbers within the press was quite frankly unbelievable. And I just on some of these numbers, and I just said to myself, that's not working. This is a rigged question and a rigged outcome, and so I'm not going to believe it.
Well, let me ask a couple more questions, Lou, then we'll let you fire away here. But I'm just looking at the numbers the last few days and what Biden's trying to accomplish and kind of what, it's funny when people look at the COVID unemployment number, all right, which they were giving people $600 a week, right? Now, everybody's in outrage. Certainly everybody on the right is in outrage because you're paying people more than I should be able to enslave them to work, right? That's essentially the other way of looking at it, Lou. I mean, I always look at things odd. That's why, I don't know why people look at me odd, which they should probably. I always look at stuff differently. And I look at it, let me get this straight. Our people, I'm not going to say idiots, our people in Washington, without even thinking about it, in order to give people enough money to live on, okay, they're essentially sending people a check for three times what most of them are making.
This was looked as a mechanism by a number of far left.
Don't look
a way
at
of
it.
Establishing universal basic income.
Okay, don't look at it as somebody who might be representing some big firm. Look at it in the sense that what does it take to live? I won't even say comfortably, reasonably comfortably is three times what a lot of people are making. That's pretty scary. And when you have the buffoons on national business TV, hey, what's Lou complaining about? He's got a job. He's making $10. What's the problem? Well, there's a big problem. I mean, does anybody put these numbers together at all? I mean, when Biden's talking about running this minimum wage up to $15 an hour, And the business people and a lot of people from the right and some people from the left are outraged. Oh my God, you're going to go from 10 to $15 an hour. Lou, my math, because I used to do this for Pullman, $10 an hour is a little over $20,000 a year. Okay? That's not a lot. 15 there makes it $30,000 a year, right? Because $20 an hour used to be the middle class. That's
so. So what?
What I'm saying is that the numbers have changed. When we have buffoons like Powell, in today's world, the median income of people is $36,000. Lou, the median price of a car is $36,000. In 1974, the median income was probably $12,000, and a car was $4,000 or $3,500. We've blown this inflation number so far out. Anybody near this $33,000 number can't. I don't know where the hell you can live in a trailer in Wyoming. I mean, we're not even close.
Those jobs.
Go ahead.
There aren't that many of those jobs. Number one, in a relative sense, but number two, those jobs, those minimum wage jobs, were never meant to be
Look,
jobs that
the median income is $37,000. $17 an hour. The median income. How does the median income less than a price of the median car? When it used to be, a car was a third of a year's salary.
Supply and demand and value added on those jobs.
Well,
I mean, is it worth an employer to pay somebody $15 an hour to flip burgers?
When the burgers are $8, yeah, or 12, where they are in a lot of places now.
No, you're not getting a McDonald's hamburger for $12.
No, but I'm saying anywhere else.
The short answer is, on that particular area, and that's a bugaboo of mine, as you know, the minimum wage was never designed to be a living wage.
I'm not talking about the minimum wage. I'm talking about the median wage. How is it? I'm going to say, Lou, that if you and I are at this Dunkin' Donuts here in the corner, those girls, they pump out per square foot more money than anybody else in the downtown area when the trains come in, when trains used to come in. I mean, is it $7, $8 an hour? When every cup of coffee went up to $3 and they're pumping out...
I think it's... In Chicago, I think it's $15.
Well, I'm saying... You know what I'm talking about. I'm saying it, the supply and demand for labor now has been totally skewed by stuff going over...
Oh, yeah.
And by mergers.
That's the problem here in Denver.
And by mergers.
I mean... Well, no, I mean, right now, in terms of supply and demand for labor, it's totally skewed here in Denver because nobody's going back to work because the unemployment benefits they're getting are better than what they could earn in wage jobs here in Denver.
Okay, but depending on what side of this you're on, you look at how it's been skewed, but it has been skewed.
I admit that the inflation has driven up the price of just basic living. I mean, you ought to. We're trying to complete a basement in a house, and you ought to see what's happening to the lumber prices, the wire mesh prices, the conduit prices. So I get the inflation issue. The point is that the jobs that you're talking about and the artificially setting a minimum wage rate is going to do nothing except drive those people out of the market because employers will not pay them that amount because that's not the value of the work that they're giving.
And who's mine? I mean, that's everybody.
The employer, and that's whose mind it counts.
Okay, but I, what I'm saying is in everybody's mind, they have a view of what other people are worth. And there was a saloon in South Bend, Lou, that said, everybody in the world is overpaid but me.
Chief, you know how this works.
I do know.
You look at your payroll. You look at your, as part of your expenses, and you look at the revenue that you're bringing in. And at some point, when labor becomes too expensive, the first thing you do is you automate. And you take the labor out of the equation. You do what you can to reduce labor costs. I mean, I counsel people on this for decades.
Well,
these guys at $15 an hour. Now maybe inflation will catch up with that, but at $15 an hour as of 6 months ago, the value of an employee at McDonald's or at Wendy's or at Dunkin' Donuts is such that the employer says, you know what? If I got to pay $15 an hour, I'm not hiring as many people. So. That you lose that benefit, and B, I'm going to move to eliminate those jobs as quickly as I can with automation, and those jobs can be eliminated.
Lou, that's what I've been my theme of the week. I mean, I know you accuse me of never having a theme. My theme of the week is all the different pieces of an economy to come together that people, when you even go into a Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's, there's all kinds of supply and demand curves in that place. There's probably hundreds of them. And they all interconnect together. And whenever you...
But you know, as well as I do, or you, because we've talked about it, the easiest thing, the easiest part of that supply and demand curve for the employer to deal with directly are the labor costs, is the labor cost.
Well, it is until you can't. I mean,
my point is that if you know, you can't affect the price of hamburger, you can't affect the price of lettuce, you can't affect the price of french fries, but you can affect the price of labor.
But labor is
the cost of labor.
Labor to these guys, Lou, when I say these guys, owners of like restaurants and stuff, they're like gasoline to the regular population. But even though gasoline could be 2% of your expenditures, every time you go on a station, the price is staring you in the face, and if it's up a dime from last week, you're pissed off. I mean,
you have an elastic demand on that, and that's true.
No, what I'm saying is it's in front of your face. But my buddy, restauranter Al, he's been on the show a couple of times, terrific guy. He was, you know, basically bitching and moaning at me one night over an adult beverage about how he couldn't get any employees. This is long before COVID. And I said, Al, how much are you paying? He goes, well, $10. I said, what if you paid 12? And I said, well, why don't you pay 12? He goes, I can't afford 12. And I said, well, let me ask you this. That's the last thing, the last check you write, and the one that's right in front of your face is the labor. Well, yeah. And I said, well, if you knew you had to pay 12 when you signed the lease a year ago, would you have signed that lease for that price? And he said, well, hell no. And if I knew I had to pay 12, I would have told the guy I couldn't pay that much in the lease. I said, why are you blaming the dishwasher?
But he doesn't have that choice now.
Well,
he's locked into
what I'm saying.
Absolutely inelastic.
But these all interconnect together, and because people are so used, you know, I'm not like I'm doing a union movement here. What I'm saying is they're all interconnected together. And the thing of it is, Lou, it's kind of sticky because if you study labor law, which I did for a whole semester at Notre Dame, or labor economics, the supply and demand for labor is the same thing as the supply and demand for corn, although you don't look at it that way because people have different skill sets. I mean, for the idea for you and I mean, there's people at the Dunkin' Donuts, I keep using that as an example,
here's the difference. I don't get the... As an individual employer, I can't affect the price of corn. Maybe in mass I could affect the price of corn if there was like 3,000 of us, but I can't affect the price of corn as an individual employer. But I can definitely affect the price of labor, the cost of labor. Corn's going to cost me X.
But you...
All right? My tortillas or my you know, whatever corn syrup is going to cost me X. And I can't affect that in the short term. When my prices go up or my lease payment changes, I don't have the negotiating power to alter that, but I definitely have the negotiating power to alter my labor costs, and I can do it immediately.
But the idea, the whole point of labor economics, Lou, is you pay a person based on what they are, quote, worth to you. And what I'm saying, that whole equation is used to say at Pullman now, is kittywampus. It's off the drawing board. If you and I went to the Drunken Donuts and put ourselves in with the ladies, and all of a sudden, I don't think we could. We'd probably be worse. But suppose we could serve 150 cups of coffee a day instead of somebody else's 125. I doubt if I'd be that quick. The ladies would be quicker, probably. Now, I don't need the guy telling me, "Oh no, you're only worth $10 an hour." What are you talking about? I just made you $300 the last quarter. You big cheapskull. I mean, what? I mean, none of that's even happening. I mean, is what I'm saying.
That's right. I mean, to the extent that the government comes in and mandates a set minimum wage based on non-market factors, yeah.
Well, but I'm saying, what are the market factors? The government allowed 200,000 people to all of a sudden be out of work. Okay, in a town like where was Squibb? Squibb was in some town in Michigan. Right, Bristol Myers buys them. They lay off, I don't forget the number, 10,000 people. Well, that's not the supply and demand in that town, Lou. It is currently until everybody moves. But you can't say, hey, You were vice president at Squibb. How about coming 10 bar for $8 an hour? That's the best you can get. I mean, yeah, that's nice, but the government just, they just affected the market, right? Now, of course, the guy at the bar doesn't want him to say, well, you got to pay the guy $10 an hour minimum wage when I can get him for $8. I'm saying they affect everything. So, all, you know, my point is that they're busy affecting everything. That's why I want to talk a little bit about what he talked about last night, Biden. But, I mean, at this point, you can't say they shouldn't affect this because they've affected everything to get you to this point, is my point, a long way of getting there. I don't know if you can debate with that too much, but I mean, you can't say that at this point that Facebook, I mean, the government allowed them to do that. They allowed, you know, there to be 4 drug companies left. If there were 8 or 10, we wouldn't have these discussions about how much people should get paid in that industry, right? If there was any kind of competition.
It would, based on what happens with the government, it would devolve to
something else.
You know, a limited number of companies because that's such a regulated industry.
Well, but yeah, they'd bleep up something else. But I mean, you can't.
I did not listen to the president last night because I, quite frankly, am not particularly interested in anything he has to say. This was not a State of the Union address. It was not an open joint session of Congress. They only invited a certain number of people to it, very few of them, members of the loyal opposition.
Oh, yeah.
And so I really wasn't interested in what he had to say.
Well, we got to go to break a little bit. Take this to break with you is if you take, I'm looking at my debtclack.org, which, you know, of course, never aggravates me whenever I do. There's 36 million people living in poverty. Now, what that means, I don't know what the poverty line is. It's probably 20 or something, $20,000. If you divided that into the 100 million, 1.8 trillion, they're giving
people.
No.
We could eliminate it just by giving them a check.
How big would the check be? $49,000. It's the exact same thing that Lyndon Johnson did. It didn't work.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. S&P futures up 28, and NASDAQ futures up 146, but it does get the market up. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708 408-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holly, Mr. Dave Scatina. The poor S&P futures up 28 and the S&P futures up 143. The twin heads of Powell and Biden have us to the moon here this morning. Plus we had some terrific earnings as the companies, all we try and do is talk about them, how bad they are, and yet they've been given the big, just keep getting bigger, Lou. At least, can they just stop talking about trying to change it when we know they're actually not trying to change it because it's the lobbyists are pouring money in their back pocket? Can we just do that? At least we don't have to listen to them. Dow futures up 130. I know I'm being a little harsh with that, but DAX down 76.5%. FTSE up 47.7. CAC around up 26.4. We're in Asia. We've got the Nikkei up 62. That's 0.2%. Shanghai up 17.5. Hang Seng up 231.8. As a way of review, yesterday Dow was down 164. S&P was down 3. NASDAQ was down 39, so down slightly. Bonds, 1.65. It's up 3 basis points. The Bund up 0.2 basis points, minus 0.21. Again, for making this like really gradual move towards zero. It'll be interesting if they go positive. Japan, positive 0.9, unchanged there. UK, positive 8.2, so that's up 2 basis points. So everybody's up here except Japan's unchanged. Oil, we got down up 87 cents, 64.73. That's it's as high as we've seen it in really quite some time. Brent up 94 cents. That's a 1.4%, 68.21. Natural gas unchanged at 2.92. RBOB up a penny at 2.08. We've got gold, which was up a bunch last night. It's only up 2.40 now at 17.76. Silver up 33 cents, 26.42. Copper up 4 cents, 4.53. And our favorite crypto, Bitcoin, is down 801 at 54,219. David, we got for us traffic, weather, sports.
Good morning. It's 6:37 in Chicago. Weather currently in Chicago is 45 and cloudy. Our highs today will be cloudy with a few showers. For our Phoenix listeners, it's 59 and clear right now, and they're going to have a high of 93 and sunny today. Traffic this morning, normal commute buildup. We do have some heavy traffic on the exit ramp to Stevenson at I-94. In sports, in major leagues last night, the Cubs lose again, 10-0 to the Braves. They're just not
what
playing.
What is with Kyle Hendricks?
I don't know. And they pitched everybody last night. Anyway, the Sox-Tigers game was postponed, and they're going to play a doubleheader today starting at 4:10. Diamondbacks lose to the Padres 12-3. In the NHL, the Sharks beat the Coyotes 4-2. And the Hawks take on the Panthers tonight. NBA, Bulls lose to the Knicks 113-94. Phoenix Suns beat the Clippers 109-101, clinched their first playoff spot in 11 years. And tonight in the NFL, it's the draft. We will see what our genius minds in Hallis Hall will do to screw this up.
They'll trade them all, probably.
Yeah.
Just saying. Hey, the White Sox are playing an old-fashioned twilight night doubleheader today.
Yeah, it starts at 4:10, first game.
Yeah, did you ever go to one of those when you were a Ute?
Oh, yes, when I was a Ute. Those were fun.
Because then you could show up at about, you'd go after work and you'd catch the last half of the first game and
right.
The full game. And
yeah, that was a lot of fun back then.
Lou, are you a twilight night? Plus, it'd be over by like 10, and 6 hours would be two games, and now it's 4 hours for one. You know, it's tough. Lou, are you a twilight night guy? You're not a baseball guy, were you?
I enjoy baseball games in person. They're great in person. I can't imagine anything more boring on television. It's rare that I would have an occasion to go to a doubleheader. I'm trying to think the last time I went to a doubleheader of any kind.
What was the last time?
I think it was actually back in Minnesota.
Here's a trivia question. What was the last year that a doubleheader was actually scheduled? I'm going to say 80? 75? David, could you... I don't know. When would you
I'll
guys
take a
get?
Look. It's been a long time.
Used to be there was a doubleheader like every Sunday.
You mean like when you say doubleheader, you're talking about a game that starts at 1 and then another one that starts at like 5 or so?
No, in those days it was 1 and then the minute the first game was over, you dragged the field and you started the second game. It was right after.
Yeah.
I mean, there used to be totally, we were scheduled doubleheaders. I'm going to say most teams had 7 or 8 of them scheduled a year. They had more off days, obviously.
I think that's right. And then they moved it to the twilight doubleheader, and I always wondered about those games because I never attended one because I thought, you know, that you're asking for a game to go into, you know, midnight.
Well, they used to start them at 4 o'clock
for that.
Well, they used to start them at like 4 o'clock. So, I mean, like at Sox Park with the South Side having all this shift work, you got people watching the first game and people coming for the second game. I mean, it was for people coming and going with the different times people used to work, and it actually worked out. I think, you know, I went to a couple of them. I mean, we'd always. And my stepfather would come home from work, and we'd head over, but we'd get there to the fifth inning of the first game or something. It'd be 5:30 at Sox Park. I mean, I don't think we ever made opening pitch for the first game, but it was an odd deal. The Cubs never had them because they never had lights. But anyway, so I mean, it is.
So I want to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to move to from our circular discussions about wages and the fact that we drive ourselves crazy going on that. I want to move to something I actually know something about and actually followed something. There were a couple of huge developments in our military accomplishments and military actions that I think for people who are looking at, and I don't know if you remember this, but in 2015, I think you asked me, you know, with the upcoming election, you asked me for my advice long term on investments. And I remember saying to you, I know nothing about investments, but, you know, if I was a betting man, I'd be investing in defense stocks. And the development that started, you know, at the end of the Obama administration and then has moved forward in under Trump, those things are now starting to pay benefits. And the point, the discussion I'm going to make is two things happened in the last 10 days that I thought were particularly noteworthy in terms of the way we are planning to fight, and your listeners may draw some insight from this. The first was an F-15 fighter over the southern test range over the Gulf of Mexico killed an airborne target at a record distance. Something, now the record shot up to that point that was publicized was something like 96 miles. So this aircraft fired a modified air-to-air missile that's currently in the inventory and killed a target apparently well beyond that range. The actual distance was classified, but well beyond that range. So that's one. The question, of course, is what was guiding it? And
I'm going to say, was it guided like
the aircraft itself, or it was something else guiding it?
I'm going to say it was guided by satellite, probably.
Pardon me?
Probably was guided by satellite or something like that.
Well, So that's one angle. The next one was a shot by a Navy destroyer firing a missile from its arsenal that hits a target more than 250 nautical miles away, which, of course, is way beyond line of sight and obviously a target that was illuminated. And, again, that was a record shot for this missile and a record shot for the Navy in terms of a ship-launched weapon that that struck a target that far away with this system.
Hey, Lou, a quick question
these
for
two,
somebody who doesn't.
These two things are indicative of what we are moving towards, and you know, we've been fighting non-peer adversaries for the last 25, 30 years, but the focus has always been in the back of the Pentagon's mind. You know, we can. With one arm tied behind our back and a relatively small commitment of resources, we can deal with these other issues. But if we get into a peer-to-peer fight against China or Russia or you know, another well-armed adversary in a small area like Iran or Turkey, you know, what's going to happen? And so the focus, and especially with combat in the Pacific, the focus has been to strike at a distance and be able to hit targets that are so so far away that we're not even going to have a good look at them before we actually launch a weapon. The development in these long range systems, the development in things like hypersonic weapons, this is another area. The Chinese and Russians, the Russians in particular, claim to have fielded an effective hypersonic air-to-air missile. A hypersonic weapon gets there roughly twice as fast as a standard launch. The Russians are claiming they've got that capability now, again, allowing strikes at very, very long distances. And this is a reflection of the way we're looking now at how we're going to have to fight if we get engaged in something. Let's say China finally decides they're going to take Taiwan. They have established, because the capability of their land-based systems, they have established effectively a bubble around their shore, which will deny intrusion by our vessels and by our aircraft in an effort to defend Taiwan. Now, Taiwan has tried to put up a bubble around itself, but in fact, the short answer is China can put thousands and thousands of missiles on top of Taiwan, which is not that big a place, and effectively overwhelm their defenses if it gets to that point. But what's more important from our perspective is we can't get inside that bubble right now, not safely and not within an acceptable cost. So we are now establishing the capability to sit outside the bubble and begin to degrade, you know, an opponent's air defenses, an opponent's surface attack capability, so that we can make that entrance. And it's something that's been a long time coming. But these two recent developments, again, for people who are looking for investments, this is the kind of thing that you're going to see a lot more of. It also goes to the way we're talking about fighting and how expensive and how lethal a peer-to-peer conflict would be, and how quickly it would go. You know, we wouldn't be talking about, you know, hundreds of deaths in a conflict. We could be talking about thousands of casualties within, you know, 3, 5, 12 hours.
Well, look, we're talking about
long range systems reach out and begin to damage and you know, destroy assets that heretofore we've kind of thought of as impregnable, like our carrier groups.
Well, but we've had for a long period of time, well, really since the drones in Iraq guide the battleships, but were still around back then. We've had the piece of equipment that targets the weapon is not the piece of equipment that shoots the weapon. So that's been around a while. This is, you're talking about something that's even more.
We've had spotters, and we've had the ability to look far away, but the ability of, for example, an F-35. The F-35 was designed to be an information node as a fighter. And so the way this would ultimately work, I mean, if we get this down, and apparently we're getting this, is you would have an F-35 or two flying over airspace, and it looks down and gets information from ships, from AWACS aircraft. These are all integrated into its artificial intelligence system, and then that aircraft not just fires a missile, say for example, against an air-to-air target, or releases a smart bomb against a surface target, but it, for example, could tell a ship, you know, fire your missile into this envelope, and by the time the missile gets, you know, up to an altitude where it's cruising, the aircraft says, okay, now I got a target for you. Or it could say, I need 5 missiles in this area, fire them now. So some Aegis cruiser fires 5 of these things into the basket that the F-35 is controlling, the airspace. And then as the missiles arrive in the airspace, the F-35 then designates targets for them.
Well, are we talking about cruise missiles that are buzzing along near the sea level, or are we talking about something that goes way up like a mortar, like a missile, like a regular missile?
Well, we're actually talking about both within you know the ability of the aircraft to communicate. So you could have a cruise missile launched from a ship, this long range surface attack missile that we've developed and that is now in final development. You could have, you know, those things that fired from a ship and entering the battle space with a rough idea of what they're going to attack, and as they enter the battle space, they receive final instructions from aircraft or other vessels saying, okay, the target that we wanted you to hit initially has now been struck. We're going to vector you away from that target within the last, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes of flight. We're now going to vector you away to a different target. The concept of this battle space is going to be long reach, strike at a distance, strike very quickly at a distance, and then strike with as much flexibility as we can. So you have, in addition to the two tests that I just referred to, recently you have the Army announcing that, you know, they're shooting artillery pieces that are reaching out, you know, 150 to 200 nautical miles with a goal of hitting ultimately targets 400 miles away.
See,
and this is absolutely necessary because the Russians' artillery pieces, for the most part, now outrange our own. And again, if we get into a peer-to-peer fight, you've either got to take those systems down or you've got to figure out a way to move so that you can't be targeted by somebody who can outshoot your own artillery pieces.
Your buddy Tom Clancy was way ahead of you when they bombed a drug lord's place and the guys on the ground put the electronic spot on the truck and the smart bomb went right for the electronic spot, right?
I mean that was at that point, that is not the kind of conflict we're talking about,
right?
That, but that's an example of the technology. The technology obviously empowers small unit tactics, like special operations tactics. The technology obviously tremendously improves their firepower with the ability for them, for example, to call down a single bomb on a particular target, or to call in and target a missile from miles away. But we're talking about something like that on a scale that, you know, covers thousands of square miles of ocean or terrain, or that, you know, basically through artificial intelligence systems effectively makes manned combat sort of the last resort. So I would expect to see, for example, across the Taiwan Strait, it would not surprise me if the Taiwanese or we had implanted torpedo mines in the, you know, on the ocean floor between China and Taiwan. And these are basically mines that contain a single torpedo. When a boat, a vessel passes over them after they've been activated, it'll fire a smart torpedo that, you know, seeks the target out and tries to sink it. Well, if you've got, you know, a couple of thousand of those things planted on the ocean bottom in a very narrow corridor, then the ability of somebody to come in and sweep those things out of there is greatly limited, because they're not on all the time. And all of a sudden you've got a pretty effective sea denial area that you're going to have to deal with some other type of AI system on your own, because human operators just aren't going to be able to pick up and deal with that many targets coming in at one time. And I would say that what we're looking at right now is more akin to the fantastic novel Red Storm Rising.
How do you find out who the people are making this stuff, and if they're making any money on it? And if you want to invest in the place, I mean, not all these guys are contracts are winners, even though they seem like they would be.
No, but I mean, if you're looking at these kind of long range strike announcements, you're talking about people like Raytheon, about BAE, British Aerospace. You're talking about some very selective, for example, out here in Colorado, some very selective, specialized boutique kind of shops that subcontract to the big manufacturers like a Litton or a Boeing or a General Electric. You know, you can follow the announcement of these contracts on the development of these systems pretty easily using Google to put search terms in. But I just note that the development of these systems and the announcement specifically of these two kinds of capabilities are something that you are now going to become over the next 5 to 10 years. These are going to become fundamental parts of our national defense strategy. Well, and they have to be.
You started off by saying for the investment piece, I mean, is it anywhere near as sexy as Facebook raising their prices 30% and getting away with it, or Apple all of a sudden going to like, I mean, Apple went to what percent, you know, I mean, we were talking about, I mean, Trump, to his credit, tried to do the best he could with China, identified it as a problem. He never touched any company that was doing business there, even though he thought he was. Apple and Nike made out. I mean, who would have thought that with a president doing that for 4 years, that your best investments would be Amazon or they're one of them, but yeah, Apple and Nike. I mean, who would even dream that those are the ones you'd want to go buy? So whatever these guys talk, whoever it is, I'm reaching a point, is it all BS? Biden and his people are going after these companies, and every senator has got Jeff Bezos and these guys in front of him. God bless it, Luke. The margins keep going up and up, the prices keep going up and up, and they get bigger and bigger by the second. I mean, is this just the opiate of the people talking to these guys while they're stuffing money in your backpack? I mean, Amazon is now the largest lobbyist. I mean, do we honestly think that any of these guys are going to do something to Amazon? If they should or not, I mean, you'd even get a fair decision.
Not only is Amazon the largest lobbyist, but they control one of the quote unquote elite media outlets, the Washington Post.
Well,
you can see the impact of that on the Post editorial policies for the last 8 or 9 years.
What do you suppose they spend with the Illinois legislature? What do you suppose they spend to not have anybody go after people that don't pay their taxes on Amazon? I mean, there's got to be a reason for that. I mean, if you don't, you get a parking ticket in Chicago, you know how they come after you.
Amazon seems to have, at least here, they've got a huge facility here in Denver. They seem to have acknowledged that tax issue is going to be something they're not going to be able to dodge, but they'll certainly try to minimize.
I know now that I pay
taxes on virtually every Amazon shipment that I get.
Have you gotten one from an independent third party? I think you're still not paying there. I'm not positive. But I generally
expect to see taxes on that because they're following the lead of the big boys.
I think that they're still fighting that. I think if you get something direct shipped from a camera store in North Dakota, I think you're still not paying. If Amazon doesn't touch it. But I don't know that for sure. But my point is, Lou, is that once you have, you can be a buffoon politician like most of them have been. Well, not actually, they do what they do very well. They're the ones making millions of dollars, not me, so they're not buffoons. But in terms of what they're doing for us, they seem like they might be buffoons. But if you spend 15, 20 years not paying taxes because your stuff's over in Europe, and you use that money to buy three or four other firms, or if Amazon used their 10-year head start not paying taxes to get to the spot where they are, Lou, unless you're an orangutan, you never look back. I mean, you never look back. It's like if you had a law firm that had 15 judges in your back pocket for the first decade, how the hell do you screw that up in the next 10 years when you have a massive war chest and nobody else has? I mean, you have to be like really bad.
I admit that these guys, you know, are going to be able to, you know, have an undue amount of influence. My point with the previous discussion point that I was making was that, you know, the attempts. We are fundamentally restructuring, irrespective of whatever lobbying is going on to be friends with China or friends with Russia. We are fundamentally restructuring our military establishment to fight this kind of a conflict against this kind of an adversary. And your listeners and your customers, your clients can find out see those kinds of contracts being awarded. And it's, I mean, it, as I said, it's not a huge.
But are they,
not a
I
huge,
guess my question is, are they,
effort
are, the, are, the com- are the companies public? We'll talk about this more next week. And are these contracts, are they all profitable? I mean, are they you know, Facebook profitable? Are they Amazon profitable? Or does the government actually say, hey, it costs you $100 million, we're going to give you $10 million in profit. That's it. Not $60 million like Apple gets, you know, type of thing. I mean,
in terms of their development, I think you're going to see and you are seeing a significant profitability jump, at least from what I've seen here.
Okay.
A significant profitability jump in terms of these kinds of very specialized entities producing the electronics and the engineering for these kinds of systems.
So I don't know whether
it's going to be the equivalent of a good day for Zuckerberg, but it's definitely a positive.
So next week I can put some of my best clients in five of these companies and work on my golf game for the next year and just be a big winner?
I would say that you're at least going to be a secure investment, and I doubt if you'll see the kind of regulatory push against those companies that you're starting to see against Facebook and Amazon.
I'm going to say that regulatory push is all BS. Anyway, Lou, thank you very much, buddy. Take care of yourself. SP Futures up 27, NASDAQ Futures up 134. Be right back, Mr. Dan Janitas.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Mr. Dave Scatina on the board. SP Futures up 28. NASDAQ Futures up 139. And your buddy Mayor Bill de Blasio says the city will reopen 100%. On July 1st, David, do you believe that?
Actually, no.
So we're talking about full crowds at Yankee games and the whole bit. I don't see them doing it, but
I don't foresee that happening.
Do we have Mr. Dan?
Yes.
Dan, how are you, buddy? Lou was just saying you should be looking at some of these companies that are doing all this high-tech stuff for the Army and Navy and buying in those things. You doing this stuff?
I have in the past. I'm not currently invested in that sector, but I have in the past. But we do have, you know, we have, you know, some of our positions should do well, like MasTec, for example, that does a lot of the infrastructure for, you know, the wireless. And, you know, I think they're going to be a beneficiary of the expansion of infrastructure, and, you know, for internet infrastructure, if you will.
How much, just off the top of your head, what Lou was just talking about, the companies that do, you know, the Raytheons in the world and so forth, that actually, all the research and production of these real high-end weapons and stuff, Is there a real lot of money in that, or is the government maintain, you know, pretty much ride herd on how much people can make on these contracts more than like
the government? The government pretty much has a stated amount. You know, it's good from the point of view if you're looking at a company, you know, especially as you're probably suggesting, a high yield company or a bond company, you know, a bond investment where you have a steady cash flow. But a lot of those companies are also, you know, any company that is dealing with classified information, we have found that although we get information, we find it a little bit tougher to get a lot of the details, especially the details when it comes to the financial side of things. So my experience has been, you know, you go in, you do an on-site interview, and you're given, like, the same talk that you could have heard in the earnings call with maybe a little bit of a chance to answer questions, but not a whole lot. I'm not sure that's, I mean, that's a, you know, I think that's a steady, I would consider kind of like a steady business and a not a bad business for a high-yield manager, but I think there's some other good opportunities out there right now. Some better opportunities out there right now.
So it takes even more work than you normally do to figure out who the good ones were in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're not quite as transparent, so that's the issue that I have. I've had, I can actually think of one meeting in particular where you know, I was having to remind the people that, you know, the more information you can tell us, the better, and they had to continue to remind me that a lot of this information is classified. So that's been my experience. We've made, you know, we've done okay in that sector, but like I said, today, right now, I see other areas that are just, you know, ripe for continued improvement. And, you know, even this current earnings season we're in right now is just, you know, the calls that I've had so far have been very, very favorable. And although kind of across the board, we're not necessarily seeing the reaction to the good news, and, you know, in the stock price, I see that as a buying opportunity. I mean, if you like the stock and the news is better, much better than expected, the earnings are better than expected, and it sells off, you know, buy more.
Well, I mean, so, Dan, how do you, I mean, when you value specific stocks, I mean, and you get a stock that's whatever they are, XYZ, they make widgets, and the stock's trading 50, and you see all of a sudden they have some pricing power. I won't blame Powell, but, and all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, wait a minute, these guys are going to be able to be charging, you know, $50 for the widget by the end of the year, and they're only charging $45 now, and it looks like their supply chain isn't near as constricted as other people's. And all of a sudden, the stock goes up, 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 and all of a sudden, the stock doubles. And all of a sudden, one day, an announcement comes out and says, hey, guess what? We raised our prices, our margins are just now, instead of being 50%, they're now 60. Well, it already went up. I mean, it's not like you're the, yeah. I mean, it's, how do you figure out whether, you know, the ingredients are already in the pie. I mean, I've always had trouble with that. I mean, the idea that when the news comes out, all the buffoons on TV say, geez, why didn't the stock double on good earnings? Well, duh. Everybody probably knew the earnings were going to be good for the last 6 months. I mean, right? I mean, so how,
right,
how do you...
But I think in these cases that they're, like you're saying, it's, you know, rather than going to 50, it's going to 60. You know, if it's a surprise on the upside, and that will, and what I'm finding that happens actually is that will eventually keep the stock price, afloat. And I think it also gives you, you know, like you said, even if it sells off, I think it gives you a little more, you know, conviction in your own, names just to see that these, you know, the companies are saying this is what they're going to do and they're doing this or even better. And at some point when the overall tone of the market is stronger on a specific day, these companies are going to have a nice bump. These stocks will have a nice bump. So yes, I agree with you. I think a lot of it's built in, no question about it. I think it's built in longer term. The, you know, the infrastructure bill and the additional spending, I think, is built in. When the good news continues to come out, though, I think in some ways it gives you a little bit of a, it definitely gives you a cushion. It might give you a little bit of a floor. And then when there's a day where everything is up, you're generally going to see a rebound, or maybe a day when everything isn't up. But there seems to be a focus. Maybe an earnings, maybe a analyst report came out, or maybe they presented at a conference and a few people missed the upside. So on the larger, you know, more capitalized names that you hear over and over again, like the tech names, that's a little easier to see. But in the names that we follow, which aren't as widely followed, there is a lapse in sometimes and the stock price recovering, it isn't really an immediate thing because there aren't as many people following it. So it's once other things get overpriced that people start looking for these, you know, smaller opportunities or ones that aren't as widely followed in industries that maybe aren't as exciting, but maybe will be a little more interesting right now with the sector rotation into some of these areas that have been left behind.
Well, I think that you're, if you listen to our two leaders speaking yesterday, until the policy changes, I mean, any time a company is not going belly up and sells off, it's got to be a buy. I mean, I'm with you on that. I mean, there's right. No doubt. I mean, we're talking about every single day, needed or not, on average, these guys are putting $9 billion in the system. And unless something really bad happens, that $9 billion's landing on somebody's desk someplace, and they're running out and they're buying bonds. Some people didn't even really want to sell them, but they're buying them at a price at which, at the end of the day, the guy's got $9 billion to do something with. And, you know, maybe he puts it in stocks, maybe he buys old cars, I don't know, but it's going to go someplace. Or maybe it just goes in the bank and somebody borrows it and they buy it, whatever it is. But the fact is, at some point, you know, and this is the part that I'm obviously way early on, the policy to me is so flawed that I don't care if the company you have, not you personally, because I think some of yours actually are pretty, actually would survive pretty well even if the thing turns the other way because they're basic places. But by and large, I don't care. You can talk all you want about Caterpillar being the world's greatest company to slice bread because this is happening, that's happening. This, the fact is, if these guys start pulling money out of the system, that thing has as much business being 40 times earnings as I do being a jockey in a seventh race today. I mean, come on. I mean, right? I mean, I think what you're doing is defining stocks that maybe haven't piled in already that high, and then, you know, and they have a pretty good chance that, you know, maybe they'll go down from 60 to 55, the whole world collapses, but they won't go from 60 to 5, right? I mean, and that's what you're looking at. And it's,
absolutely, yeah.
But it's hard.
Yeah, and I think just like you're saying, there's just like getting that affirmation that that we're going to continue to see the liquidity in the system, you know, especially after Powell's speech yesterday, that there's not going to be any, there's no major fear of inflation longer term, and that definitely will benefit all of these companies. I think that the one area that we might be not necessarily concerned about, because I think it's already built in, but the one area that we haven't really had a final word on yet is what's going to happen with corporate taxes. And although there's a lot of talk out there, there's still going to be, I think, a period of time where there's going to be a discussion that's going to probably back and forth that'll end up with a tax rate that's not going to be excessive. And so I think that's also giving these stocks some buoyancy right now, or giving them some downside protection, because they know that it's very unlikely that we're going to see the high end of the range on the tax side of things. So yes, I agree with you. Most of the news is already in. There's a lot of liquidity. The names that we follow, again, I think it supports some of these smaller names that wouldn't normally have this liquidity. So I think that's the other benefit, that it's going to keep them afloat. And as I've mentioned in the past, it's keeping a lot of the names that we follow on the high yield side afloat as well. You know, again, we talked about EM Trust. That's a property casualty insurance company. We own their private bonds. We're able to buy some at about 6.25%, you know, 2.5 years. AIFC is their ticker symbol. They're going to be around for a while. I mean, they're, you know, in a decent business. And, you know, you're still getting a really good spread. You know, high yield spreads have come in. You know, we started talking, we were in the higher threes or mid threes over treasuries. Now we're in the lower threes, even high twos. But, you know, I think as I mentioned before, you go back to, you know, just prior to 08 and the spreads were at 212, 215. So I think just looking at the high yield market, there's still room to go. And I think now equity investors are pay attention to high yield a little more, and they say, okay, well, you know, even though the valuations might seem stretched in some of these names, all the earnings are coming out good, that, you know, the forecast is really positive, and high yield hasn't reached its peak yet either. So I think that's one more reason to think that this rally is going to continue. And, you know, yeah, I don't know that there's any major concerns on, you know, at least the, like you said, the two talks that we heard yesterday from the officials were relatively favorable for our business and for I think for a lot of the names that we own. And you know, and again, and not that they're necessarily new news, but it's just good to get the affirmation.
Well, but certainly in my lifetime, you never would expect anybody. I mean, these people. How can I say this charitably? I can't. They're not as intelligent as a 21-year-old guy in college. At some point, the 21-year-old guy in college, when the last guy shows up with two cases of beer, is going to say, "We got enough beer. The party start again tomorrow night. Go home." I mean, we were always able to do that. These guys are not going to stop loading somebody's pocket until something like really bad happens. Where they, even with their people lying, they're going to have a 2% CPI 1 month. And all of a sudden, when they panic, we went through this before, back in the 70s, and I can't believe they're trying it again. But I have a quick question for you. How is it in today's economy? I see the commercials, and I see where they're putting them. How all of a sudden, Dan, is it seems like every insurance company is printing cash. I mean, for God's sake, they got the bird guy, they got the progressive people, they got the guy with the mustache.
Yeah.
I mean, is there that much money in car insurance that these guys, they picked up for let's put it this way, Viagra and the other guy, the pills were what, $45? and the generic is what, $5? So,
right.
so clearly there was some markup on that stuff. And those guys were $50 million a year to the NFL, right?
Right.
And they'd have to be the same thing to CNBC. I mean, and all of a sudden now, they're all been taken over by insurance. Is the markup on insurance like it was on Viagra? I can't believe that. They must be making dough somewhere.
Yeah, I think the insurance companies over the last decade or two have gotten really wise to, you know, to managing their losses and their risks. And I think that's, you know, and certainly the market has helped. Because when you think about their reserves, you know, how their reserves have traditionally been invested in fixed income or higher quality, and they've done well. I mean, their performance of those reserves has done really well, so they have probably a little more leeway than they had in the past. But I think a lot of it's managing risks, you know, all the exceptions that they have to what's covered and not covered. And, you know, that wasn't really the case many years ago, and especially on the property casualty side, that's become the case, you know, as they pay more attention to the, you know, the higher, you know, when they have to pay out higher sums to their customers, that's when they're looking at it and saying, hey, how can we get around this? So they might still pay, if it's, say, a homeowner's policy, they might still pay to fix your sink if it's a minor problem. But if, you know, if you needed a whole new, system, electrical system, air conditioning system, you know, it might be a little bit tougher to get that than it had been in the past. So yeah, I think some of it's management. I think some of it's the operations and how they've managed. Certainly all these companies have also been able to manage a lot leaner, you know, with staff that are leaner. And I think the focus is different than it was in the past.
Well, Dan, you're closer to this than me, but I'm going to guess that, again, if I'm way off, just tell me, because I'm talking, but I'm asking. An insurance company, I'm going to say, has some stocks, which obviously have done well.
Yes.
But most of the time, I think in a term regular world, I would say that they would be mostly fixed income. Now, there comes a time when Dan is managing State Farm's portfolio, and Dan buys something for 6%, so you pay, you know, 95 for the thing in the market, and all of a sudden the rate goes to 3, and Dan's going to say, well, gee, this piece of Duke is trading 130. I think I'll sell it right here to say thank you very much. Obviously, you've done exceptionally well with that portfolio because you made, you know, $30 in 1 year versus dragging the 6% for the rest of your life. But when you start doing that to everything, all of a sudden, you do have this pile of cash that you've made a lot of money on, but now what have you done for me lately? What can you do for it today? And the answer is nothing like you did the last 2 or 3 years. So where in that kind of, I'll say, bubble or trench, or where are they in that? I mean, they had to have sold everything long term and gotten a capital gain. There's no way you're going to hang on to a 6% deal that's trading like 135 and just hang on to it, I don't think. So, but now what? You're just stuck with cash. I mean, I guess if they took it and put it in the market in the right stocks, they'd be geniuses, but I don't know if they do that quickly, do they?
Generally not that quickly, but what they have done is that they do play the fixed income market, as you're saying, and they got into the 10-year when it was at 175, and then as it dropped to like 160, they made some money there as well. So, they are generally fixed income players. They would be more apt to buy preferred stocks as well, and that's one thing that we've been pushing. We still think the preferreds are a good place to be. You're still getting substantial yield over treasuries. You're getting huge yield over high yield right now, and you've got some good names like we've talked about, Blue Knight and Chicken Soup for the Soul preferreds, now yielding 9%. They've been paying their dividends lately. We have another company, AIMC, that is, today they're actually reporting earnings this morning. That's a company that's going to benefit from infrastructure. They do motion like gears and for different machinery and equipment. And they just announced a better than expected dividend. So those types of, I think those types of things are ways of continuing to keep investor interest. In terms of how they're managing their own internal, I think that they've done somewhat like what we've done here, which is they've managed their risk because they're not getting as much yield. They've looked for other places where they can get it that are still, you still have strong risk controls, and maybe they're not going all out in equities, but maybe they've increased their position in equities, if they're allowed up to 10% or up to 20%. And they're not going in on the tech names. They're going in on the names that are paying dividends and the names that are a little more solid, like some of the names that we've mentioned that I think have a good, have some downside protection as well. And it's not a hard market to predict right now. I mean, unless something horrible does happen in the near future, we're seeing probably a lot more confidence in the market, a lot more confidence from consumers, a lot more money in their banks. So this is, I don't want to say it's a risk on time, but it doesn't have to be a risk off time either. So for those, insurance companies, for example, that are able to buy down the spectrum, if you will, on the corporate, on your capital structure, there are going to be other alternatives, both in the convertible bond space and the preferred space, as well as, like I said, in the equity space on some of these dividend stocks. So we've seen some really great performance in some of the dividend stocks that we never would have seen this report. Performance 10 years ago, never would have seen this type of upside. A couple of the names we've mentioned recently too that I've talked about, like AIMC, which I just mentioned, is up really nicely. It's like 30% since we started purchasing it. And here's a good example, I think, of a talking about a way of making money in this environment. So Matson is a company I've spoken about before. They have they pay a small dividend. They're a container ship company that's predominantly based in the Pacific. So their regions would include they're taking goods from China to Long Island, Long Beach, the port in Long Beach, the port in Oakland. But they have Guam as one of their stops, and Hawaii and Alaska. And that's what they know best. They're not trying to branch out of that area. There's been huge demand. There's been lines to get into the port of Long Beach. They have, because they've been at it for a while, they have priority. This stock had we were buying in the 50s. It ran up into the low 70s. Earnings came out yesterday. They were much better than expected. Everything was very positive, and the stock has dropped about 3%. So that, to me, is a buying opportunity with a company that's stable and steady. And what they're benefiting from is not only the influx of goods from, the household goods coming from China, but also, the U.S. has got, is now shipping certain aggregates, and, they're going to benefit from this infrastructure as well, expansion infrastructure as well. So they're, raw materials that they're delivering and so forth. So here's an example of a good solid company that's been around forever, that has a product that, or business, I should say, that is, it has high barriers to entry, and they're, you know, you've got a stock that just traded off 3 or 4% in the last few days after terrific earnings. So I think we have a, like, at least now in the very short term, we have a good buying opportunity, but holding a name like this long term is really, really where you want to be. You know, I think over the next year or two,
by the way, Dan,
you don't have to be moving in and out of the stock. It's one that I think is a good solid position.
Dan, you just reminded me of a question the listener had for you. You talked about these guys on the West Coast, and actually have a few listeners that live in like Carolina and Virginia, and they claim that the amount of container ships over there, they've never seen so many of them. Who's is there an East Coast equivalent that you like? I mean, who'd be the ship going by Carolina, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, there really isn't one, I think, that I can think of off the top of my head. There a lot of the names that come into the East Coast are, say, German companies or companies coming over from Europe. So they're based over there. We haven't done as much homework on those names. We particularly like Matheson because it's a U.S. headquartered company. It's based in Honolulu. They have a big operation in Oakland. Most of the competitors are coming from Europe. So you have, like, some of the Northern European companies that are coming into their ports, you know, whether it be, you know, like Savannah, Charleston, other ports in the southeast. So, and the dynamics over there are different in terms of the pay. And, you know, we're looking at China on the other side, right, who's producing all these goods very inexpensively still. So that's where the Pacific region, I think, tends to have the benefit, or maybe look a little more attractive, because demand has picked up in this sort of stay-at-home environment for household goods, and they're sort of busier than they know what to do with, and they've also created a route where they're able to take some stuff back, or at least part way back. So, you know, whether they go to Hawaii or Alaska or on
the
way back
to
China.
They actually have, when you say they're headquartered here, are the ships, wasn't there a period of a couple of decades where there was no American flag ship anywhere?
Yes, yeah, and there's a, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but there is a rule of law that's been around forever and ever, and they have the benefit of being a U.S.-based company with U.S. ships, with the U.S. fleet. So that actually gives them a huge advantage in the Pacific region. That's definitely an issue, and that probably wouldn't be the case on the Atlantic side.
So there's no, the stuff from Atlantic are just coming from individual places, and it's hard to put a,
it's coming from, like I said, Europe, and a lot of these companies are German or Norwegian, or, you know, they're the container ship companies. Some of them are Greek. So a lot of them are European-based as opposed to U.S.-based. And we do have the benefit in the U.S.-based companies, again, with the U.S. fleet, of getting some additional cost benefit. And also priority. I think priority is the big thing in terms of getting into the crowded ports.
Well, isn't there something with the if your U.S. flag, you can, the other guys can't, they can only go from foreign to here. They can't go from here to here. Or something weird like that. So
yeah, that's why I'm blanking on the name. There's a rule or a law that's been around forever and ever, but it's definitely one that benefits Matson. So yeah, good company, good solid management team. You know, again, having a history, you know, like the other companies you talked about, Federal Signal in Chicago and Aztec, which is a company that does aggregates and asphalt. And these are companies that have been around forever and ever, and now they're at a time and place that they're, with the expansion in the economy, they're going to benefit.
Well, anything, if you have any kind of spot where you have any kind of pricing power, this is your life. I mean, this is the year to make it happen.
Yep, absolutely. You're going to be at the head of the line. So when it comes to the pricing power, and and also it's really not just that, it's also really having the experience and having the relationships, say, with the people in the ports and all that when it comes to Matson, but also with the other companies it has, that we're talking about, it has a lot to do with the relationships that they've built over time, that are really secure, and that's what they really rely on. Like a company like Federal Signal that does a lot of trucking for the specialty vehicles for construction. That's one of their big businesses, and specialty vehicles for cleaning sewers and infrastructure. And they have these relationships, these deep relationships that have been built over centuries that they've developed.
Oh, because when you build something like that for somebody,
that's what gives them the heads up.
It's like building a fire truck for somebody. They expect that thing to be working 50 years from now. I mean, it's that kind of a relationship and that kind of a piece of machinery. Dan, thank you very much, buddy. As usual, really good stuff. Who's their big competitor? Who's the big? Is it a Japanese company? Who's the other the massive container group?
A couple of Asian companies that they compete with, but most of them, believe it or not, are smaller. That are going from one place to another place. They're not as large a player. Matson has a lot of market share in the Pacific.
Okay.
So
they're not trying to recruit the guy who ran the container ship into the Suez Canal wall, are they?
No, not at all. In fact, I've asked them that question many times. Are you going across the sea? And they just stick to what they do best in the locations that they know best. And the way they've expanded is by getting into like Hawaii and then Alaska and then Guam, so that they have like a stop off point on the way back. And then now they're in, they stop over in the port of Seattle as well. So they're having, they rather would become, the number one player in the Pacific region than trying to go over to Europe where there's a whole totally different dynamic.
Well, it's a fascinating industry. Dan, thank you. SP Futures up 29.
Sure.
NASDAQ Futures up 145. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Howie, Mr. James Cantina on the board. S&P Futures up 30. Yeah, 30. It's some good earnings. We had all kinds of crazy stuff from the president and our Fed chairman, but basically we had some terrific earnings out of Facebook. I got Facebook up $24, trading $331.51. Apple, big increase in margins, meaning they raised prices. Up $3.33, now they're $1.36. I actually thought they'd be higher, but they are not. But Facebook sure is. And Qualcomm's up $8.03. They had earnings last night as well. Ford, not so hot. Ford is down 45 cents to under $12. It's one of our holdings of a lot of my clients, and they came out and said basically the chip shortage is really hurting them. The tune of like $2.1 billion over the next couple of years. So I don't think that their chairman gave the right story that everybody wanted to hear on the call. They were doing all right till the call, but after that, not so much. Dow's up 147. Individual stocks, now like I said, Apple's up 337. We've got Goldman Sachs up 223. Most of the rest of the stuff, Merck actually had earnings. They're down $1.50, but not horrible. Over in Europe, we've got DAX down 66.4%, FTSE up 43.6%, CAC around up 30.5%. So DAX down, the rest of the guys up. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 62.2%, Shanghai up 17.5%, Hang Seng up 231.8%. Bonds making a decent move up here, up 4 basis points to a 1.66. The Bund positive 2 basis points to minus 0.20. Heading towards zero, but still a ways away. Japan unchanged at 0.09. UK up 4 basis points to 0.84. It's as high as we've seen those guys in a while. Oil up $1.08 to $64.94. Brent up $1.19, $68.46. Natural gas down 2 cents, $2.93. RBOB up 2 cents at $2.09. And we've got gold up $1.20, so pretty much flat here. At 17.75. Silver up 28 cents, $26.40. By the way, GDP jumped 6.4% in the first quarter, which was actually 6.5 was expected, so pretty much right in line. Copper up 4 cents, $4.52. And we've got crypto down 5.51 at 54,549 for Bitcoin. David, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
7:37 in Chicago. Weather currently in Chicago is 45 and cloudy. High today is going to be 57 degrees, cloudy with a few showers. For our Phoenix listeners, right now it's 60 and clear. They're going to have a high of 93 and sunny today. Traffic, we're having build up as normal on the Kennedy and Eisenhower due to long-term construction. Normal slowdowns there. We got an accident report on the Ryan at local lanes right before 43rd Street. Stop-and-go traffic. Expect 20-minute delays. In sports last night, Major League Baseball, the Cubs lose again. 10-0 to the Braves. Sox-Tigers game was postponed. They're going to be playing a doubleheader today starting at 4:10. And the Diamondbacks lose to the Padres 12-3. In the NHL, the Sharks beat the Coyotes 42, and the Hawks take on the Panthers tonight. NBA Bulls lose to the Knicks 113-94. The Suns beat the Clippers last night 109-101 to clinch their first playoff spot in 11 years. And tonight, the NFL draft. Also, we have the Kentucky Derby this weekend. So I did, Tom. I looked it up. The last year of the doubleheader was actually 2001, and then the collective bargaining agreement got rid of it.
There actually was a scheduled one in 2001.
Yeah, wow. That's what I read.
There couldn't have been too many, though. I think they were kind of falling off.
I think they only had one per team, one day.
All right.
Those Twiniters, Tom?
Yep.
Yeah. That was the games that I used to see as a kid most often because they were, you know, reasonably timed. And you also had free fireworks courtesy of Bill Zach at the end of every one.
Yeah, well, so the Cubs last night, 10-0. Would it be fair to say that the game was not as close as the score would indicate?
Well, they even had Anthony Rizzo pitch to one batter last night.
He struck a guy out. He struck out the MVP.
Yeah, he struck out the MVP, and the Cubs haven't scored a run in two games.
Yeah, it's a well, you know, as a guy who's a, I mean, hopefully I'm still going to be playing some softball this year. I haven't played yet. Basically played some semblance of baseball my whole life.
I mean, I like the announcers and stuff the Cubs have, but this new vote thing in baseball that it doesn't matter what your batting average is. Can anything be more BS that there is? If you're batting 250, you get a hit every four times, which means you're probably hitting the ball at least every three times because most of them don't fall in, right? Well, if you're going to be a guy who gets a hit, not just hits the ball, but gets a hit one out of three times batting 333, that is a dramatic difference. You can't tell me that somebody who's below the Mendoza line at 180, but he walks once in a while, he's just as good. No, he's not. I mean, where does anybody even come up with stuff like that?
I don't know. That was always the key statistic, I thought.
if a guy gets 30 hits a week versus somebody else getting 20, you don't think it makes a difference on the team? I mean,
it's a huge difference, yeah.
Would have to be. So, John, I asked you to be on because you can counsel me because I was having trouble with Lou. when I say having trouble. And you know, having troubles with the listeners and everybody else I try and talk to, because in my opinion, I think the numbers that we're talking about now, since they've been allowed to be miscast for periods of decades now, it's reaching the point where the percentages are totally out of whack, to where even if these guys are successful at raising the minimum wage from what everybody earns, from 10 to 15 bucks an hour, which I don't think they're going to be, plus they're talking about over a period of 4 years. Jan, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, the prices and the other stuff has gone beyond the person making that kind of salary. Now, I know, you know, that the right wingers, of which you are one, lock into the fact that, okay, well, it should be, you know, some kid in high school should be making $11 an hour at McDonald's. I get that part. But the fact is, there's a lot of people at McDonald's now that are working that have college degrees that aren't the kids in high school. I mean, I also know that's happening. But you know, we've gone so far from this. I mean, I just looked up on break that in 1980, the average amount of wages that went in an automobile were 40 hours, and now we're down to 30. All right, so in 1980 or 79 or whatever, because I noticed my parents bought one. They bought a 79 Oldsmobile Delta 88, which is a pretty darn nice car. I'm sure Dave remembers it. I'm thinking it was $4,500. And you paid people 40 hours to make that car at roughly $20 an hour, which was defined as the minimum wage back, or not the minimum, the middle class wage. So now you got somebody putting in $30 an hour, and I'm saying the guy might be making 30 to 35, maybe. And if you're a new guy, you're probably making less than the 20 that they made in 1978. So how exactly does it work that the median price of the car now is $32,000? I mean, what we're not even on the same planet. And this is what I've been trying to convey the last couple of weeks, and to be perfectly blunt, I've either done a horse bleep job or people just have no idea what I'm talking about. And we've gone so far and away from the numbers that it almost doesn't matter if somebody makes 10 or 15 bucks an hour, or certainly not 10 or 15 it does, but 10 or 12. We're talking about a state that wants, you know, what, 650, 700 hours to transfer a car from one person to another? 60, 70 hours at $10 an hour to transfer your car over? We're talking about a red light camera is 4 hours work, a parking ticket is four. We're not even on, I mean, what are we, we're so far afield from anything normal that I remember, or not remember, but think is fair. And Lou and I are arguing about a girl working at the, girl, they happen to be, I won't say all girls there, at the Dunkin' Donuts serving, you know, 400 $3 coffees during a day and making $60 or $70. I mean, what are we doing? I mean, I know that I'm sure the guy at the Dunkin' Donuts thinks the person should work for a dollar less, but under what theory does he get to do that? And if you and I
well,
went,
it,
you know.
It doesn't make any more sense, really, for the federal government to arrive at a $15 an hour minimum wage. when it comes to looking at the bigger picture that you're talking about. You know, the only field of reference people have, and I think you and I both have it, and I don't know how you have another one, what can you get with what you have? And what is completely out of sight, you know, for the long term, based on what you have? And cars and houses and travel, you know, things like that, were education. Those were things that people above a certain, you know, earning power could easily afford without bankrupting themselves. But all that's been detached from earning power. So now you've got, you know, disaffected people earning ridiculous wages. Most of what, you know, creature comforts people aspire to are just off the map for them. And I don't see that, you know, making college free or all the other things that our president was talking about last night come close to fixing anything. It just makes the problems worse.
Yeah, you want things to be priced fairly. I mean, you don't. I mean, when we went to school and Dave went to school, I mean, I'm going to say the median. I'll dig it up here, but I'm going to say that Notre Dame was, if you paid your room and board our senior year, I didn't have to pay because I was an RA, but say it was what? It was pushing $4,000, $3,800, something like that, with the room and board. And I'm going to say if you worked on a line at Pullman, you made 16, you know, or something. I didn't probably make as much there as they did at General Motors. So it was roughly a quarter of a reasonable blue-collar job's annual salary. And now it's double a blue-collar job's annual salary. That just can't be, John, and for a long period of time. It's on an absolute scale, it sucks. On a relative scale, it really sucks. It's not worth a two full years' salary to sit there at Notre Dame 15 hours of class a week. Sorry, it just isn't. I don't think.
No, and if you make college or community college free, and, you know, up the amount of Pell Grants and everything else, what you're really doing is just debasing a college education even further, such that people will be even more disaffected with how little they can do with that degree once they get it, assuming they do get it. But it isn't as if this puts them in any better position to compete against people who don't have a college degree. It just makes them more unlikely ever to have some of these creature comforts.
Well, when you lose the discipline of people going there, having to have it, I mean, again, I'm I don't know, I shouldn't have taken so many classes, but I am an absolute slave to this economics, because I honestly believe it tells people, not as to whether I can predict the GDP next quarter or not. People, you know, put their nose down an economist and say that's not what economics is all about. Economics is how you distribute scarcity, how you do it, who get, because there's not enough of everything for everybody, and how do you decide who gets what? And your economic system essentially does that. That's the discipline to the system. That is the system. Now, the idea that you're going to make something free, it's, first of all, you know it's not free. It costs something. Now, the question is, how do you make it efficient and competitive? That's not what Biden's talking about. He wouldn't know that if you slept him upside
down. No, it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
It's to debase it in such a way that there's no reason for competition.
I'm going to say that the last system that I knew about, and I there might be others, but the University of California system was, quote, free to residents in California up until how many years ago? I don't know. David, do you have any idea? I don't know. But I don't think it is anymore. Now, granted, you know, they started to have you paid room and board, and there might have been a bunch of fees and a bunch of other crap, basically. But up until not very long ago, if you were in California, your tuition was, quote, free or included or whatever you want to call it, right? Now, if you were from out of state, I think it was really high. It was probably higher than, like, Notre Dame or Northwestern, but to go to Berkeley or someplace, assuming you get in. But I did the math about 5 years ago, Jan and David, where I took the entire amount of money that there's seven schools, right? There's Berkeley, there's Cal Poly, there's Santa Barbara, there's like seven.
Clara, Irvine.
Yeah, there's like seven, I think, six or seven actual University of California schools. And then the other stuff, you know, they're not affiliated, but they have a massive facility in Oakland. It's an indirect facility, meaning there's 300 people that work there that aren't even within miles and miles of a campus. Now, what they do, God only knows. So I took the entire amount of money that the, uh, system. This is 5 years ago. There's a system spent and divided it by the amount of students, you know, which is sloppy, but it's the best I could do. I came out with $100,000 a year was their, quote, cost. So the difference between making something free or not is a fool's game. It just means that this person's not paying for it. Somebody else is going to have to. Now, in a community college, I should know this, David, if you wouldn't mind, what does it cost to go to Richard J. Daley or what's the one downtown, Harold Washington? I'm going to say is it $5,000 a year? Now, why should that be free? I mean, it's not like it's 70. It's not like somebody couldn't borrow five. I mean, we're talking about, is it five or is it more than that? I don't know. That's what I'm asking. But, I mean, out of all the things that maybe should be free, somebody's ability to pay, you know, $500 for a course at Harold Washington, is that beyond the realm? I don't think so.
It shouldn't be.
No, I mean, because it is, you are getting something of value. Now, you know, our friend Professor Eric, I don't think Eric in the last 20 years has had his salary, you know, quintuple. I'll bet he's up 25%. Maybe. You know, so the whole idea of what exactly are we doing to these places? I mean, I'm going to say that a professor at Notre Dame in 1974 made $20,000 a year, right? And now he makes 100. Is that fair, John?
Yeah, I think that's. Yeah.
And so a student paid 4,000 then, and now he's paying 70. That's one guy's up five times, and the other thing's up 10 times, roughly. Nine times. Well, that can't be if you want to keep things normal. And so, but how do you go back and say, I mean, the professors I don't think are anywhere near the highest paid people at Notre Dame now are the people who run the endowment and go out and go bother people for money, right? It's not the professors
right,
anymore.
The development people and the physical plant people and, you know, institutional planning and research. All these are huge industries now at every college. They have to be. And those people are, you know, can kind of write their own tickets. I think if they don't go to Notre Dame for a job, that lots of other places will pay them more to do the same job. So I'm just looking at my old institution here, Tom. In-state tuition currently, this is I think 2020, $9,342 a year, and $11,064 for out-of-state students.
Now,
so that would be, you know, two semesters of community college. Tuition, assuming, you know, you're considered a full-time student. So
that's doable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And those students, I would say, you know, typically 70 to 80% of them had jobs, too. Some of them lived at home. Some of them were married. Some of them were 60 years old. They're all over the ballpark. But most of them worked and were doing, you know, an education the hard way. But it was worth it to them to suffer a little bit because this was a dream they had, and they know that, you know, the dream isn't worth too much if you just get handed it. So,
well, how much did
there was some value, or it instilled a positive feeling, I think, in students who were struggling to do this when the easier thing would have been to just, you know, make a little more money and sit around a lot more and be, you know, maybe a little more unhappy. But the students who didn't want that were willing to make life tough and take night classes and everything else and go without other things. I think that was a very positive thing in deciding who goes to college and how, you know, likely they are to stay in college.
What percentage of the $9,000 do you think goes to professors? 30% at best?
Not even that. No.
Which is insane. I mean, if you look at some of these numbers, I guess it's past the statute of limitations when somebody is no longer alive, right? But people who've listened to the show for a long time remember Bob Golden, real good friend of John's and mine. Bob was probably the smartest tax guy, one of the nicest guys you ever came across. Well, he was involved in the, what shall we say, international tax work. Is that a fair statement? How can I?
Yep.
Let's just say that Bob might have been one of the minds behind the double Dutch sandwich and all the rest of the stuff that we rail about all the time. Anyway, so Bob retires and he's going to become an adjunct professor at Notre Dame. And he lives where he and Kevin were there, and Kevin and Bob were the best of friends. And we'd go down for a game, and we'd always have Bob and his wife's spectacular. And so we'd have anyway, we'd have a nice time. And so Bob, of course, Bob being Bob, we had to do everything perfectly. So he goes, Tom, there is no book on this stuff. It took me 3 months just to put together a class. It had to be from all the stuff we did at the accounting firm. There's no book I could just buy and say, you idiots, read chapter one tonight. It's not like that at all. I mean, he goes, I had to put together an international economic or accounting taxation class. It took me like forever. You know, once I did it, then it's been there for, I say, I add to it every year. He goes, but it was 3-4 months work before I even got in near a class. And I'm thinking the Notre Dame Business School, they're not University of Chicago, so they're probably up to $5,000 a class. So I think Bob told me, John, that he had probably 25 people in the class at Notre Dame, and they were doing that, you know, storefront MBA stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think he had as many as, 40, 50, 60 at those places, maybe more, at $5,000 a pop. So he's talking maybe 70 people at $5,000 a throw for the semester. So that's $350,000. I think, because he was an adjunct professor. Now, they gave him the ticket to the parking lot so he could, like, park close for the football games and stuff and basketball. I'm thinking, Jen, they paid him $5,000, maybe $55,000.
And that's well paid for.
That was well paid for. It might have been less. It might have been, like, $35,000. I mean, what kind of margin is that? That's like Viagra margin. What do you, let's see, $300,000 versus $3,000? What the hell?
Well, and, you know, that's part of the, you know, the problem of pandering to people's taste. Everybody can go to college, get everybody in here, fill up all these seats with willing butts and bring in the money. And where does it get actually paid out? Where does the benefit go to the, you know, the tax bodies or the districts that are supporting these things? It certainly doesn't go to the people who are producing the education. So the formula for Illinois community colleges is supposed to be 33% tuition, 33% state infusion of funds, and 33% of tax money from your district. So that has never really worked, I don't think, in the last 20 years for any Illinois community college. But if you say, okay, now 33% of that formerly paid by the students is going to be federal money, the federal government's going to dictate the curriculum offerings,
sure,
the textbooks, everything else, the assessment procedures, the retention standards, all of the data is going to have to be crunched through the federal government. So it isn't as if this reduces the other 66% of the budget. And by the way, I mean, this is kind of, it's all been out of, kilter for a long time because tuition money has been ramped up as the state has lagged behind with its funding. But it isn't like all of a sudden the taxpayers in a community college district won't have to pay anything on their tax bill anymore, or the state won't have to pay it. They'll be paying more. So you're getting, all it does is reallocate all the students' tuition money that's coming in to the taxpayers generally.
But what are we,
hardly a savings to anyone.
But when we get to the point where your direct expenses, meaning, you know, the heat for the classroom, I was going to say the chalk on the board, got talking all old I am, and the professor, when that starts to get to be like 10% of the cost, I mean, what are you doing? I mean, where's the rest of the dough going? Who are those people with their hand in the pie? I mean, you got to have, I mean, what, real quick, we only have less than a minute. St. John Fisher, John, had 34 teachers, 2 janitors, 1 principal, an assistant, and a music teacher. So they had 5 indirect people for 34 direct people. What do you think the now in a regular school, it's got to be 3-1 indirect to direct?
Oh, yeah.
And why? I mean, what is it? Should it be 10-1 or 20-1? I mean, why not 100-1? Why not have everybody on a salary there, even though only one person teaching? It's crazy. John, thank you very much, bud. SP Futures up 31. NASDAQ Futures up 164. David, thank you as well. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.